You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
Arnie Sherman, good morning to you. How are you this morning?
You know, I'm doing pretty well considering fall is over, golf is over. We're in the beginning of winter here with snow and below zero temperatures. Other than that, I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm doing great. Well, look, I mean, by popular demand and the demand of our audience and the demands of actually telling a life story in a format like a radio show, we are destined to go to part two of the Arnie Sherman story this week. As you'll to refresh our listeners' recollection and memories, we covered Arnie is telling his life story from growing up in New York, and just the different work and jobs and interests he's had over the years, his family, all the way through to his finding the University of Cincinnati as his college of choice, and actually his first big relationship, where he met his first wife in Cincinnati. And that's kind of where we left it, Arnie.
Well, we went a little bit further, actually, Scott. We went into the draft and my first summer job outside of college after I graduated.
That's right. But,
it's more than just me telling my story, because that's hard to do. It's your craft in asking questions about my history and life to date that has sort of led the charge on how this conversation has developed.
Well,
and you
good.
Could have done it many different ways. And I'm taking notes, because when we're done with me, you're next up. And I might approach it completely opposite. I might start with the day we recorded and work backwards to when you were born.
Mine's not as interesting as yours, I'll be
sure. We will make it interesting.
Well, anyway, look, I am so thrilled that we're doing this, Arnie, as you know. When we come back, we will start with part two of the Arnie Sherman story and saga. Back after this.
Hunter Baycock.
Arnie Sherman, we are back.
Before we can begin part two, there are a few highlights about part one that were left out, and I don't necessarily need to go into them, but I just want to sort of toss them in there, because I was thinking back on what I said, and there were a few highlights. One of them was the opportunity to play basketball in a pickup game with the big O, Oscar Robertson, when I was a freshman in college.
Sure.
That was a memorable life, you know, remembering experience. I had a chance at LaGuardia Airport to talk with Bobby Kennedy during his run for president. And for a psychology project in college on the psychology of humor, I had a chance to interview Bill Cosby, which was an interesting experience way back then. So those were three things that popped up that surrounded, you know, the narrative that we've already covered.
That we've uncovered here.
Yeah.
It's interesting, but I mean, that's the thing. Like, if we were to say Oscar Robertson, Bill Cosby, and I think we're going to have a couple of other names that we're going to insert into today's interview.
Yes.
Arnie has not only rubbed shoulders and met and worked with some very prominent people, but he's also found himself in some interesting situations and unlikely situations, which is the Zelig quality that I tried to talk about and you've talked about on the first show, right? How do you find yourself in these situations, Arnie?
Well, I try to live a life, you know, worth living, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and take the cliched road less traveled. And if I see an opportunity to expand my experiences, expand my exposure to different people, I've tried to take those. During my life, the first political campaign I handed out flyers for was when John Lindsay, who was a Republican, was running for mayor of New York in 1965. And as a Republican, he had the endorsement, interestingly enough, of the Liberal Party. And in fact, the posters that I was handing out were posters that were done by Peter Max for his mayoral campaign. And so, You know, back there, politics were less strident and the divisions were, you could be a liberal Republican running against a conservative Democrat. That doesn't exist anymore in our current political landscape. But it was, you know, and so I try to take advantage of, you know, situations and try to insert myself into them, not in a way that was gratuitous, but because I would find it interesting.
So curiosity is something that really, I guess, is, it's fair to say, kind of drives you in a sense, learning new things, trying new things. You've never been afraid to try new things.
No, my whole career has bounced from different work focus or foci, from doing youth work to doing international leadership work to doing university work at the University of Montana and several other universities to, you know, doing finance and managing foreign investment money to radio show and podcast show. You know, I've tried to take advantage of things that have come my way and work with relationships that I've had to make my life interesting. Because when it's all said and done, you know, when you're the downside of a life, you want to look back and say, you know, I have very little regrets or no regrets. I mean, that's the best anybody can say about their life. You know, if they're looking back and reviewing it, you want to say, you know, it was a life worth living. I wouldn't do it much differently, and I don't have any regrets.
Arnie, take us back to Cincinnati now. We're now looking at the late 60s, early 70s, right? You're early 20s. Because you went to college early. You graduated high school early. So you were talking about your first job and the work that you were doing there. What was that experience like for you? Because, I mean, as talking about a series of firsts, what was that job like? I mean, you were really thrown into the lion's den early.
Well, I was working, as I mentioned last time, at the Ohio Bureau of Vocational Rehabilitation. And I had a very heavy caseload because it had been unattended. Right. And it was people, as I mentioned, people waiting for prosthetic limbs, people waiting for training materials so they could go to vocational school. There were people that were, you know, just out of prison that I was dealing with. I mean, I was 22 years old. I'd buy guys, I would underwrite or support buying barber tools, barbers, shears and scissors for somebody who wanted to be trained as a barber, and the next day he would sell it for heroin, and I have to go and deal with that sort of stuff. So I was thrown in very unusual circumstances, and one of the things that I remember learning was I had a psychology degree from a very good psychology department at a good university, good enough that, you know, NYU was interested in me for their doctorate program, but there was nothing that I learned at school that prepared me for what I was dealing with. I mean, right. You can study, you know, Adlerian or Freudian psychology and, you know, dissect the human psyche and learn about the id, ego, and superego. But when there's a guy standing across a pool table with a knife in his hand, not wanting you to take his stuff away from him, there's nothing that you learn can help you deal with that. You just have to use your own common sense and your own aggregate, you know, knowledge based on your life. And if you're not used to that kind of experience, it took a while to adjust. But I found it fascinating.
Who did you rely on for feedback? And who did you rely on for feedback? And so you're so young to bounce. I mean, did you have a good supervisor there or a good mentor there?
You know, I really didn't. My next job, I sort of stood out because of the work I was doing, and I was under fire. And there was a halfway house program that still exists in Cincinnati today called Talbert House. It's a huge agency that works with ex-convicts in the criminal justice system. And they reached out to me and said, would you like to come work for us? You know, you look like a guy that gets things done and throw yourself into the breach, and would you come work for us? It was a guy who's no longer with us, named Bubba Henderson, who was a former deputy warden of a prison in Alabama who had come up to be the number two person at this law, at this program. And I thought it would be fascinating to do, so they installed me as the assistant director of a halfway house for ex-convicts. And I'm still 22 years old, and all of a sudden I'm working 70 hours a week with 15 guys who are being released from prison, who require, you know, supervision and transitional help into the community. And, you know, I just found it, you know, a very interesting experience. And while I had a supervisor, they all had their hands full. I mean, I was thrown into the breach kind of like, you know, right. Swim or drowned. You know, and I had many, many interesting experiences, you know, in that environment and that sort of job. And really, I did it for 2 years. And at that point in time, I was really kind of burnt out. I mean, I had no life outside of it, really. I was working sometimes 15 hours a day, 6 or 7 days straight, you know, supervising the house because the halfway house had to be personed full time.
Sure. So did you keep in touch with people from that early role with the halfway house?
In fact, the executive secretary to the executive director there, a woman named Mary Kay Meekum. The last name is because she married a good friend of mine who later worked for me. Mary, who I've known since 1970, we're still in touch and talk and see each other. And her husband, who had worked for me also, we stay in touch. And, you know, those for all of us were our formative years. And you're looking at a time where there's great social unrest going on and there's, sure. You know, racial tension. And I'm a young white guy working in a halfway house that's mostly non-white residents and trying to relate to them and help them to make the transition. You know, at night I was going to get my master's degree at Xavier University because I couldn't go to New York at that point. I already missed my opportunity to get a doctorate. I had given up my occupational deferment to get thrown in the draft, and I didn't get drafted. And so I was able to take this job at the halfway house, and I was, you know, I was working. So that kind of, you know, I threw myself into that. And it was very interesting because my friends, I realized later on that after I left there that for 2 years, all my friends, all my contacts, all my stories, all my jokes, all my music, all my daily experiences were with ex-convicts. In some cases, convicts. They were all convicts. They hadn't been released yet. This was the 90-day pre-release experience that they were having. They were murderers, armed robbers, rapists. All these guys were there, and I'm spending, you know, from morning till night with them. So it was really kind of an, you know, interesting experience and learning about cultures that I had not personally been engaged with.
Sure. And with that first kind of that series of jobs, when did you go from Cincinnati? Where did you move to next? And what was the job that took you there?
Well, a job opened in the adjoining county, which was Butler County, Ohio, which was a fairly large county. It's 300,000-400,000 people, so it's not a rural county. They were starting a countywide youth agency. Back in those days, there was a lot of federal money going to try to work with disadvantaged youth. And there was money to start what at the time were called youth service bureaus.
Sure.
And I applied to be the director of that agency, and I lied about my age. I realized there was somebody else competing for the job who was 40, and I'm 24. So I felt I had to say I was at least 25.
Wow.
So I fibbed a little about my age, and I got elected, chosen by the board of directors to start this new youth agency that ended up adding a runaway shelter to it. I ran one of the first half dozen runaway shelters in the United States. And it was the first co-ed one. Mm-hmm. So it was that was an interesting experience. I kind of built an agency from the ground up that became nationally recognized and award winning. And, I was able to apply, you know, what I learned at the halfway house and at school. And, you know, that's where I met Linda. She was the first person, that I hired to come work for me at the Butler County. I didn't know her, but she
came. What year is this?
This is 1972. This is way back in the previous century. We're all kids running around. As I look back, I am shocked that the probation and parole officers in town, that the schools, that all of these folks were willing to allow, in a conservative county, they were willing to allow us into their institutions to help their kids. I'm not even sure we could do it again today. I mean, you know, Linda, who was running around in those days in an army jacket with a peace sign on it and bell-bottom jeans, was going to schools, you know, talking to kids and working with the, you know, school administrators. And I can't imagine what they really thought about. We were pretty, I wouldn't say cocky. We were just excited about the opportunity to try to do something that hadn't been done before.
And for those that don't know who Linda is your wife.
Yes.
And you met her in 1972.
Yes.
Where is she originally from?
She was from Cincinnati, and I went up there to speak after I got the job, and her mother came to an event that I spoke at, and then later I was interviewing, and she had been working at a group home, and so she had some experience. And she had grown up in the Ohio area. She had gone to Ohio State. She had worked in a children's home, so she had some good experience. And I immediately hired her and brought her on board to work at the agency. It was a small agency to begin with.
Right.
We opened up other offices. We had all kinds of interesting programs. We had some innovative programs that today don't even exist that we tried back in those days. We had when kids ran away from home, that was probably one of the most traumatic experiences that they could have. And usually they were running from something rather than to something. And when they would be picked up by the police or somebody and brought to our runaway shelter, they were in crisis, and their parents would show up, and there would be, or if they had parents, and there would be some traumatic experience going on. And we created a program that allowed that had family counselors available 24/7. So when the family showed up at that traumatic time, there was a trained professional counselor there to mitigate and mediate what was going on. And we found that to be very effective, you know, rather than trying to, you know, wait 2 days and everybody has a different, you know, right in the middle of what, with all this emotion, have somebody professional there to try to, you know, get to the bottom of it all.
Sure.
So we did things like that and launched some early youth employment programs and did a lot of court diversion projects. We were doing a lot of fun stuff and innovative stuff. And again, I'm shocked and surprised. It was probably our false bravado that knew what we were doing that allowed, you know, all of these other organizations and agencies allowed us to, you know, ply our craft when everybody there who was working was under 25.
Right. So when you met Linda, she worked for you in 1972.
Yes.
How
yes.
long did you stay at that agency together? Or how long did you stay at that agency, and then how long was she there?
We were involved in work and in the same social circle. She was married and I was married at the time, at the very beginning. I ended up getting divorced. Not because of her. I wasn't dating her. I wasn't involved with her. She was married, and her husband at the time was one of my best friends. And then over time, over about a 3-4 year period, she ended up getting divorced. And we didn't really start dating until about 6 months after she was divorced. And when it became clear that it was going to be serious, we came to the mutual conclusion that she would leave the agency, that we wouldn't have any kind of conflict of interest. There were a lot of other employees. We were dating, you know, it looked like, you know, we were probably going to get married. And so we didn't make any sense for her to continue there. And we both stayed there till 1976 and then left and went to Florida. My father, who had never asked me to do really much of anything, he never asked me to help him or to I need help. And he was running a business in Florida and asked me to come down and help him do it. And so I thought it would be a good change of pace. I've been doing youth work for 6-7 years since I graduated college, youth or criminal justice work. And I thought I would want a little change. And so we moved to Florida to
where in Florida?
Down in South Florida, and you know, right around Boca Raton. We lived in Coral Gables.
Oh my gosh!
And my father was in the carpet business, and his brother was in the furniture business, and I got involved in that for about 9 months, and couldn't wait to get out of it. And so,
I don't know how you would ever do retail, knowing you the way I know you. You would
because the family kind of asked me to, and they never asked me to do anything before. And I was burnt out with what I was doing, and I thought it would be a decent transition. I hadn't lived around my family since I was a senior in high school, you know, and, you know, at this point I'm 28 years, 28 years old almost. And so right. I decided to go there, but, you know, and I did it and it was interesting, but I didn't want to do it. It was a good learning experience. I got out of it as quickly as I could. And actually went back to Ohio for a short time, and then I was offered a job in Washington, D.C. to be deputy director of the National Youth Work Alliance to do lobbying and advocacy work on behalf of kids.
Got it. And you were and what's interesting, knowing you the way I know you, so Florida then is not just about work and where you're living, but what was the – I know you love food. I know you love sports.
Music scene was pretty good. Matter of fact, there was a time when Linda was in the hospital in Florida. They thought that she had cancer and was going to die, which fortunately turned out that was not the case. It was a misdiagnosis. But she was in the hospital, and Billy Joel was performing in Miami, and I snuck in the hospital and took her down the back stairway and the fire escape, and we went down. You know, I brought some jeans and T-shirt and stuff for her, and we went down and saw Billy Joel in concert. There's always a thread of music in, you know, in everything. You know, at the halfway house, music was running all the time. At the youth agency, music was running all the time. You know, college, you know, obviously college experience, putting on your Craig headphones and listening to Whole Lot of Love by Led Zeppelin and all that sort of stuff was, you know, there was always I could link what was going on in life to record albums and music.
And you know, talk about that for a second, because that's something we didn't talk about on the first call, was right even from the get-go as growing up in the New York City area, you spent a lot of time going and seeing shows in and around Manhattan, but also on Long Island, right?
Yes. There was a club called The World at Roosevelt Center, and groups like Jay and the Americans and the Four Seasons and Little Anthony and the Imperials and groups like that, Joey D and the Starlighters, Chubby Checker, all these early 60s groups would perform at those places. And obviously, the British invasion came along, and that was, you know, sort of tempered by what was happening down in the village with, folk music, and then leading into, you know, Velvet Underground, Nico and Lou Reed kind of things. And then the spoken word, there were spoken word albums. People don't pay attention to those much anymore. But back in those days, you could buy, you know, records of Woody Allen and Lenny Bruce and Shelley Berman and Bob Newhart and Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks doing the 2,000-Year-Old Man, and later Richard Pryor and Sam Kennison, all that stuff was going on when you couldn't see those people in person. So there were different times, different moods. I can remember the first time I heard a Beatles song, exactly where I was, the first time I heard Billy Joel, the first time I heard, Led Zeppelin, the first time I heard Velvet Underground, first time I heard, all those kind of groups tied into, you know, parts in the life. James Taylor. James Taylor was a big thing in college when Sweet Baby James came out.
I think that musicians and singer-songwriters, certainly in that era, in the really that original era where they really, that's where they came out of, was the 60s and 70s. They were like cultural icons. They were touchstones. They were speaking for the population.
Well, I can tell you one thing that would stand out. You've probably had experiences like that. It's 1973. I'm driving down the highway. There was a radio station in Cincinnati called Jelly Pudding. That was their nickname. They said, we have a record from a new artist from New York City. Billy Joel, and was Captain Jack.
Oh, wow.
And I actually pulled off the highway and stopped to listen to that song on the radio, and then drove to a record store and bought that album.
And bought the record.
Yeah.
And because it spoke to you. It was your life.
Right. I was a kid growing up in New York who was watching people out, you know, around him, you know, getting into drugs and getting high and, you know, feeling, you know, it was sort of a musical representation in a weird way of The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman. You know, sort of lost soul, not figuring out, you know, what to do with his life. And, you know, you're 24 and your mother still makes your bed was one of the line. And I knew guys like that. I wasn't one of them because I was gone by 17, but I could, it resonated with me. And of course, Billy Joel grew up in the next town from where I went to high school on Long Island. So he was really, Well, he grew up in around Massapequa and, you know, Oyster Bay. In one of his songs he uses in the Ballad of Billy Kid, he talks about it from a town known as Oyster Bay, Long Island. He was from that whole area.
Arnie, so, let me just do a quick idea. Yeah. Our guest is Arnie Sherman on his own show, What Do You Know? We're doing his life story part two. Arnie, when you – so, you know, in the 60s and certainly in the late 60s, you know, as music was really becoming so important to the culture and to the politics and just, you know, and you were kind of in the throes of it, whether it was in Cincinnati or New York or elsewhere, like for big events, like with Woodstock, where were you for Woodstock? Like, did you contemplate going to Woodstock?
Or were you? I was already working and couldn't go. I mean, you know, it was
that responsible.
I mean, I was working for the state of Ohio at that time, and I just couldn't go. I knew about Woodstock, you know, and, you know, I drove onto college campuses where the National Guard were attacking students. I was on a Ohio State campus when the National Guard were throwing tear gas on students back in those days. And of course, you know, memorialized in, you know, Kent State memorialized in the song by Crosby, Stills, Nash, you know, right. Ohio. Right. Linda was on the Ohio State campus when that was going on. She was a student there. She was involved in, you know, peace protests and that sort of thing. I, from college until now, I have never gone more than a few weeks in my whole life without having a full-time, at least one full-time job.
I was going to say, it feels like you had to grow up pretty fast.
Well, I needed to because my parents weren't very well off and I had to pay, you know, I had a scholarship and I actually at a point in time when I was working two or three jobs in college was sending money home to my family. You know, so it was a tough experience. I felt a sense of responsibility, you know, like for example, a lot of my friends in college were, you know, I couldn't drink my first year, but later on I was not a drinker. I don't think I've had 2 6-packs of beer my whole life. I didn't smoke dope till I got out of college. Everybody was smoking dope. I just didn't do it. I was too, you know, I my mind was, if I do this, I'm going to get lazy. I'm not going to be able to keep these jobs. I'm not going to be able to support myself. I'm not going to be able to continue on this path. And, you know, I was pretty motivated to try to do, not make something of my life, but have a life, you know, worth living.
Sure.
My grandfather sort of instilled that in me. You know, when
I was gonna say, who was the influence? Was it your grandfather or your
father? Yeah, he was once sick in the hospital and people thought he was going to die, and you know, I was very shocked by all of that, and there was this poignant moment where he wore this little ruby pinky ring. He took it off and gave it to me and said, "I'm not going to need this anymore." And that was very emotional for me. You know, fortunately he didn't die for, you know, he was ill, but he lived for 3 more very productive years. But he said to me, just promise me one thing, you know, that you won't listen to what other people say and you will essentially, you know, take the road less traveled. And then he looked at me and said something that I remember to this day and think of often. He looked at me and he was about 66 years, 67 years old at the time. And I was, 21 or something like that. And, right. 22. And he said, it feels like it was just yesterday when I was your age.
Oh my God.
You know, and I felt like, I really felt like my finger had been, you know, sort of stuffed into an electric light socket. Because I realized at that moment there was this sort of connectivity that it is like 40 years, 45 years goes by like nothing. And now I can tell you it does. Looking back now, I say it just seems like the other day when these things we were talking about now happened, but they're, you know, they're 40 years ago.
Yeah, you mark your time based on different life events. And
different things that popped up, different people that you have contact with, different experiences. You know, it's mostly connections emotionally, like with music or musical theater. I used to spend a lot of time listening. I could memorize lines from almost every Broadway musical that was out there, you know.
Broadway for your generation was really important show to.
Well, there were things like West Side Story. Right. You know, that was interesting. There was Hair. There was Jesus Christ Superstar. There were Lenny on Broadway. I saw Lenny. I used to go to Broadway as much as I could. I would see as many shows, you know, Death of a Salesman with Lee J. Cobb. You know, I mean, great actors and great shows, you know, Camelot with Richard Burton, you know, playing King Arthur. Those kinds of things had very meaningful, you know, connection to me. You know, and then I saw people out in real life that, you know, also were, you know, sort of like mentors or heroes, or, you know, if I had a chance to be around any of them, I would take the opportunity.
Well, you said on our last show that writing was such a passion for you, writing, creative writing, and certainly storytelling.
Yes.
In that you seem to really enjoy, whether it be a sports story, right, of your beloved Yankees, or like you're saying, shows, you know, Broadway shows. These are all story-driven kind of.
Sure. And people's life. You know, we've had Uncle Harry on the show, you
right.
know, my late Uncle Harry, and he had lived a life with many stories, many, many interesting stories from, you know, as you know, from being at Yankee Stadium when Lou Gehrig gave his "I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth" to being, you know, in World War II at, you know, in the Pacific Theater, and, you know, joining the Army in 1940 and being a sports broadcaster. I mean, he had a lot of interesting stories. And it's easier to relate to stories than to, you know, words or situations. A story kind of captures a point in time that has a message to it.
Do you think we as a society have lost the both ability to listen but to tell a good story?
Yeah, I really do.
We're all, it's all,
well, because of social media, it's all tweets, you know. 200 characters or whatever. It's tweets and TikTok and headline news and all those sort of things. People don't have the time or patience. You know, even in the case of doing this, there's some trepidation about, guy going to stretch this out to two or more shows. I mean, who's going to listen to 90 minutes of anything?
But I think the devil is in the details, certainly, that you need a longer format type story to be able to tell a good story and to be able to provide more insight into who you are.
Well, for certain people, but I'm not so sure the younger generation. I mean, I'd like to see the demographics of who watched 60 Minutes, which is probably the most, you know, formative news show that allows you to explore a topic, at least, you know, a topic for 15 minutes, which is a long time on TV. But I bet you the number of people under 30 who watch 60 Minutes is very narrow.
It's very narrow. Well, you know what was interesting? As you were talking about comedians, certainly in the 60s and 70s, and how the long playing record, the album, was the format that you kind of discovered Woody Allen or Richard Pryor, Cheech and Chong, all these, like Steve Allen, Shelley, all these kind of, you know, these influencers, if you will.
Right.
Now, young people don't even, you know, they have to, Netflix or Prime Video is how they discover social commentators that are like comedians. So they have to, the pictures have to kind of accompany the words. And to me, it's, there's something lost in having to almost present too much of the storyteller. I'd almost rather hear it just audio wise and imagine what's happening.
Well, that's the way it used to be. I mean, you know, there used to be tabloid type magazines, but, you know, you would learn about new music by listening to the radio. That's
right.
How you found out about new music. You would learn about new movie stars by going to the movies. You wouldn't say, boy, I've just read about this great guy, I got to go see him.
Right.
You would go to the movies and then say, I like this person, I'm going to keep an eye out for him in the future. There just wasn't as much exposure to what we have now in terms of the inundation of you know, where things source from. I mean, as you know, somebody can go on a YouTube channel and have a billion downloads, and a lot of people have never heard of that person before that happened.
Yeah. Well, I think what's, you're 100% correct. Certainly the younger generation needs that accompaniment of the visual, whether it's a video or what have you. But I think you and I talk about this, like, podcasts are great. Like, audio on demand is great because it still allows for the theater of the mind to kind of let my imagination kind of really further engage me into what's being said or what story is being told, which that's important. You kind of get it. I think it hits you differently than if everything is just presented to you and thrown at you as a picture or a visual.
Well, the other thing that's different from, you know, my formative years and now is you know, you didn't, you could listen to the radio, and your family, if they could afford it, would have record albums.
Right.
And when the radio wasn't on, you played the records, you could only play what you had. And right. So I had a chance to listen to, you know, records and music from 30 years earlier, 20 years earlier than, you know, so stuff in the 20s and 30s. And my parents' tastes were some of, that I acquired because of that.
Sure.
Now it doesn't necessarily flow the same way.
Well, exactly. And you back then, if you identified with your, what your parents like, people would have thought you're square, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Whereas now, for sure. Parents and kids kind of like the same music. And in fact, they're meeting about music. You know,
that's well, the funny thing was, I mean, rock and roll, as you know, changed all that in the 50s and 60s. It's right. Still here. You know, rock and roll is here to stay. Before that, you were listening to Bing Crosby and Rudy Valli and, you know, maybe Frank Sinatra was the pinnacle of all of that. But once rock and roll came in, you know, Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry and all that, and then music continued, you know, you can make an argument that while there's all kinds of permutations, it's still all some form of that that's still here. Rhythm and blues, rap,
right.
You know, it's all, it's so you can go back to the 80s and 90s and listen to Run DMC, and it's not that much different. If you go back 30 years from when we were kids, you're listening to waltzes. You're listening to a whole different style of music.
And
you're watching Fred Astaire and, you know, that sort of thing. So,
right. And rock and roll, I think, rock and roll is about rebellion and rebelling against your parents.
Right, and rebellion is still part of the music scene in one form or the other.
So let's go back a little bit. And by the way, we're having
memories.
We're going through memories with Arnie Sherman, part two of our story. Arnie, yeah. We're in the mid-70s, mid to early 70s. You're in Florida. You're in Coral Gables.
Right. 76.
So 76. Where did you go from there? Like where?
I got a job offer to go to Washington D.C. to run the National Youth to be deputy director of the National Youth Work Alliance. We moved to Washington D.C. We live in at 1765 R Street in DuPont Circle, and that lasted for about 9 or 10 months. And it was a tough job, and it was interesting, but it wasn't really my forte, and I wasn't in charge. And up until that point, by now, I've been running things. And I was the deputy director there. And then a position opened in Chicago running the probably the most well-known local coalition of youth and children or agencies called Youth Network Council of Chicago. And they asked me to come out and interview, and they offered me the job. And I moved to Chicago to run a coalition of about 100 youth-serving agencies in Chicago. And then I immediately expanded that to a statewide organization called the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. That was created in 79. It still exists to this day as a voice, an advocate for children and youth in the state of Illinois.
What was that, like 77?
I moved there in 77 and stayed there till 82.
Did you work with the local government, with the mayor, Mayor Daley, and the and that whole?
Well, when I got there,
was it the older?
The mayor was Blandick, and then became Janie Byrne, and then became Harold Washington before the Daleys. But Richie Daley was the U.S. state's attorney, and I did work with him a lot.
Did you?
And probably one of my greatest accomplishments is I helped lead a coalition that rewrote the juvenile code in the state. So at the time I got there, kids who basically juveniles were in many, many places put in adult jails and adult lockups. And about 50 to 60 kids every year died from being in those facilities. They hung themselves or were beaten or there was some tragedy. And about 50, 55 kids a year or died as a result of being put in. Can you imagine? You're a runaway. You're a 15-year-old boy, and you get run away in a rural county, and they throw you in jail with adults for a couple of days.
Oh, you know, it's just like forever.
Yeah, yeah. So I helped rewrite the juvenile code in Illinois, and the year after that was done, I think there were none. No kids were put in those adult facilities. So I felt very good about helping to accomplish that. Then I moved on to Kansas City for a couple of years, running a national children's organization. And then I started getting involved in internet.
Slow down. You're going too fast for me.
Well, we're only up to halfway through, and we're, our time is limited today.
Oh, we're going to do a third show. But anyway, Arnie, so you're in Chicago. You're doing all this stuff in Chicago. You've always worked with youth, right? You've always worked with
Well, up, I basically did that for half of my career, and then moved into youth leadership work, and then into business. There was an opportunity to transfer into to doing business, and I felt that I had done as much as I could as a youth service advocate and a youth agency manager, and one of the difficult parts of that was you were constantly out raising money. It was a never-ending life of raising money, trying to run an organization, trying to manage it and raise money, which is a whole different process than having customers or clients, because the customers and clients of these agencies weren't the people that were paying.
Right, sure.
Third-party paying. So you had to convince a third party to pay for these other services.
What motivated you, though, to do your work with young people, right? Because was there some,
Well, I started working with even my first job working with for the Bureau of Vocational Rehabilitation. I had youth and adults as part of my caseload. Then I was working with ex-cons for 2 years, and then this opportunity to start a youth agency. I had learned at school and in my experiences, how disenfranchised young people were. They don't vote. They don't have, they don't have that kind of influence. And lots of rules, regulations, policy, that affect their lives were being promulgated without any of their input. And they needed a spokesperson. And so it just felt like a natural fit for me to be in youth work, even though my training had been in psychology and I liked counseling kids and I continued to do some counseling. I quickly had a broader aptitude for managing organizations and advocating, being a spokesperson. For whatever reason, and it wasn't me being pushy, maybe it was just being, I like to think dynamic and charismatic, but wherever I would go, I would get elected to be the head of the state association, the chair of the board, that sort of thing. And so I realized that I had sort of a calling in taking a leadership role in that particular industry, and I was good at it.
Did you and Linda ever contemplate starting your own family or having a family, especially when
we did, and unfortunately, Linda could not have kids. Mm-hmm. And at the time that we contemplated adoption, which is when we live in Chicago, both of us were working full time. We had professional careers. And one of us would have had, in fairness, would have had to stop work and take on that role. And that particular time period, adoption was very, very difficult. And to be very candid, the adoption availability at that time was mostly for special needs kids, children, to adopt special needs children.
Sure.
And as a first child, I didn't feel like that was the right decision for me. And in fact, I went partially for a couple of years into therapy to try to work through that. Was there something wrong with me? Because I didn't want to take a special needs child as an adopted child. So maybe I made up a little bit for that, on-air psychoanalysis by thrusting myself into, trying to build youth service agencies and working with
It's very honest. It's very candid, and it's I appreciate it. I know just in observing how you speak to young people, certainly my boys, you're very good with them. You're very engaging with them. You really speak to them on their level and treat them with respect. And I appreciate that. And that's clearly who you are, but also your experiences.
And I always felt a responsibility when I was working in children and youth work to make sure that there were women and minorities in the staffs and the organizations that I ran. In Chicago, when I ran the Youth Network Council, there were two or three white people on the staff, and the rest of the staff were minority members.
Sure.
I felt that was important. If you're going to be working with minority populations, it shouldn't be this weird dichotomy of white people telling, disadvantage minorities what they should be doing with their lives. So I tried as much as possible to promote and integrate minority staff into the operations, even before it was politically fashionable to do that.
Right.
We have
about 4 minutes left. What I was hoping to do is let's take us to the next role where you kind of transition to the leadership role, management and business.
A couple of quick things just to share. So I started getting some media exposure in Chicago. Phil Donahue, who was Oprah's predecessor and probably the hottest TV personality, he asked me to co-produce about 4 or 5 shows on youth work with him.
Really?
And so I was on the air with him on 3 or 4 shows. And in fact, I was asked by the Today Show on one of those shows to fly to New York with Phil and do a 10-minute segment on the Today Show with Phil when Tom Brokaw was the host of the Today Show. So that was my 5-minute claim to fame. I was on the Phil Donahue show the same day I was on the Today Show, and my parents got to see both of those on the same day.
That's incredible. This is at the height of when Phil Donahue was.
Oh, he was the hottest show around. It was the hottest talk show around.
And Tom broke up today. Same thing.
Yeah, it was the height of both of the shows. It was a very good, interesting experience for me. I had never done that before. But what happened was I started taking on a greater leadership role in youth services, and I was asked to get involved in helping take a delegation to the World Forum of Students and Youth in Helsinki, Finland in 1981. And I was very excited, my first international business trip. And then Ronald Reagan was president and declared Russia the evil empire and canceled all trade and dialogue and interactions between organizations at the time. So those of us that were going kind of got pissed off because we were all excited to meet our counterparts from all these other countries. So under the auspices of the YMCA of the USA, we put together an informal U.S. delegation and went over there and did this conference. And it was eye-opening to me. And as a result of that, the formative group that was there representing the U.S. delegation helped form another organization called the American Center for International Leadership that was designed to bring emerging leaders of the United States in contact with their counterparts in other countries around the world, particularly countries where we didn't have great diplomatic relationship. This is called, sort of back channel diplomacy. And we got the Eli Lilly and Cummins Engine and Rockefeller Brothers and Ford Foundation all put up money to help support this organization. I didn't go to work for them, but I was a board member through their entire existence. And was at one point chairman of the board.
How old were you when you started doing this work? This was the early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s. So it really kind of
30s at the moment.
Yeah, I was getting old to be a young leader, but I was, I was like 30, 31, 32 years old.
Amazing. I mean, it's just a lot of responsibility at a young age, and you continue to get so much have so much responsibility.
I started taking delegations of young American leaders to places like Russia, where no one was going. There were very few Americans ever allowed in at that time. And we would take 15 Americans for 2 weeks into the Soviet Union, which it was in those days. And then we'd host a delegation from the Soviet Union. Our group brought Boris Yeltsin to the United States for the first time he was ever in the U.S. and took him around. And he was a seminal figure because he was the transitional leader after Gorbachev that allowed democracy to, sink its roots into the Soviet Union, break it into the republics and separate countries and keep democracy going until Putin got his hands on things.
Exactly. Well, let's take a quick break. Our guest is our co-host, Arnie Sherman. We're telling his life story. 45 minutes goes by pretty quickly.
Anyway, yes, it does.
Back after this. All right, we are back with our final quick segment with Arnie Sherman. Arnie, we've told a lot right now in the life story of Arnold Sherman. What are we going to learn next week?
Well, I think we're going to go from how I began doing international work to the point where now I've traveled to and worked in over 100 countries, dealing with Vladimir Putin, helping U.S. companies work around the world. My my transition from all that to coming to Montana to teach at the University of Montana and help build the Montana World Trade Center, and then my life since then, because I ended doing that 6 years ago.
Arnie has a real right, and this is the best is yet to come, ladies and gentlemen.
I think so. The more interesting things, the one that I think would resonate with our audience the most, have happened over the last period of time, from then till now.
Exactly, and we'll leave it at there. You know what, Arnie? I will see you and speak to you next week.
Looking forward to it, Scott.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.
There, I'm Rob.